welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau. This week we celebrate Independence Day and the creation of the Democratic Republic known as the United States of America. But ever since that fateful day in 1776, there has been debate on whether voting in the U.S. is a right or a privilege, or even who should be allowed to vote. That is the subject of this week's conversation between Talking History's Fred Nielsen and his guest, Alexander Kazar. And following that, Dr. America, a regular on Talking History, joins us. This time he raises the question of whether we ought to celebrate the 5th of July as well as the 4th. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On July 1, 1863, the Battle of Gettysburg began. It lasted 3 days and proved to be a turning point in the American Civil War. After defeating the Union forces at Chancellorsville, Virginia, Confederate General Robert E. Lee decided to invade the North in hopes of further discouraging the enemy and possibly inducing European countries to recognize the Confederacy as an independent nation. When he got to Gettysburg, Lee encountered the Union Army of the Potomac, led by General George Meade. The second day of the battle proved crucial. On that day, some 15,000 Confederate troops assaulted Cemetery Ridge. The Southern spearhead broke through, but the force was so weakened by artillery fire and lack of reinforcements that it could not hold the ridge and had to fall back. On July 4th, Lee retreated to Virginia. Losses on both sides were among the heaviest in the war. Of 88,000 Northern troops, casualties numbered about 23,000. Of the 75,000 Southerners, more than 20,000 were lost. In November 1863, President Abraham Lincoln would give his famous Gettysburg Address at the dedication of the National Cemetery honoring those who died in that battle, declaring that the dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, last year President Bush signed a law authorizing a national memorial in Washington, D.C. for John Adams. However, disagreement over its location has stalled the plan, although the bill says only that the memorial would be built on federal land in the Washington area. Representative Tim Romer of Indiana, the project's chief supporter, said at a congressional hearing that he'd like to see it built in the mall between the Jefferson and Washington monuments because of Adams's link to those presidents. Last September, three federal commissions that oversee the design and placement of national memorials in Washington adopted a plan that bans additional monuments on all but two sites in the heart of the mall. Romer's site would violate the new restrictions. Meanwhile, historians are rushing to put the events of 9/11 into the books. New editions of history textbooks are appearing that include accounts of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The challenge, explained Roger Roglin, president of Macmillan McGraw-Hill, was not only to update the books quickly to meet deadlines that dictate the books be on the market before the next school year, but also to assure the material's accuracy as new information continues to appear and new accounts are offered weekly. This is Talking History. Although the percentage of Americans who choose to vote is not impressive, we consider it our basic right, an essential part of the democratic republic in which we live. But the struggle over the question of who should vote has gone on since the writing of the U.S. Constitution, which actually is silent on the matter. Fred Nielsen discusses the history of voting in America with Alexander Kazar.
Voting is the most basic political act in a democracy. Yet, unlike the rights of speech and assembly, the right to vote is not enshrined in the United States Constitution. Indeed, the Founding Fathers viewed the franchise as a privilege, not a right. Here to discuss how Americans moved, often fitfully, from the limited suffrage of the 18th century to the universal suffrage of the 21st is Alexander Kazar. He is a professor of history and social policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government and the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States, which was a finalist for the 2001 Pulitzer Prize. Professor Kazar, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Contrary to what many people might assume, the right to vote is not formally enshrined either in the original Constitution or in the Bill of Rights. Why not?
I think the answer is really twofold. The basic answer is that most of the Founding Fathers did not see voting as a right, and certainly not as a right that belonged to everyone. The second part of the answer is that the founding fathers, in drawing up the Constitution, had to contend with the fact that each of the new states already had its own particular voting requirements. They varied from state to state. And the drafters of the Constitution, such as Madison, were very concerned that if they developed any kind of federal requirement or federal suffrage law, that would antagonize people in one state or another and thus jeopardize ratification. So what happens at the outset, and one might think of it as the original sin of suffrage or voting rights law in the United States, is that questions of suffrage, questions of a right to vote or who would wield the privilege of voting were treated as largely outside the domain of the federal government and left to the individual states.
Perhaps you could take us through American history then. What percentage of adults has been able to vote at various times?
Well, it would look something like the following. Obviously, until 1920, women in nearly all states could not vote, although they attained the franchise in some states between 1890 and 1920. So up to that point, we'd be talking about the male half of the population only, and then if one deducted as well African Americans who only briefly were able to vote in the South and in the North as well, I would say that we're talking about in terms of adults of both sexes, we're saying until 1920 the percentage probably ranged from about 20 to perhaps a maximum of 40%. Since that time, obviously the figures double in 1920, and we're around 70 to 80% nationally until the 1960s, and then there was obviously a major surge from 1960 to 1972 with the federal government's intervention to try to guarantee the voting rights of African Americans, and in so doing, the voting rights of others who were also discriminated against.
At first, as we've mentioned, the United States viewed voting as a privilege and not a right. When and how does it come to be seen as a right?
It comes to be seen as a right gradually, but really in the first half of the 19th century, and with really an expansion of a broadly democratic ethos, the growth of a different kind of middle class, the growth of sort of cities, and the insistence of various groups, for example, in states that had landowning requirements, the insistence of people who did not own land that they ought to be able to wield the franchise as well. There is a lot of struggle over this question of whether it is a right or a privilege, and the rhetorical dynamic in general was that people who were trying to claim voting as something that they wanted to do insisted that it was a right. People who were trying to deny their right to vote said it was a privilege. But even those who saw voting as a right, for example, Martin Van Buren in the 1820s in New York, did not necessarily see it as a universal right. So then the debate became, well, if it's a right, but in whom does this right inhere? So the short answer to your question is I think that one sees it pretty widely accepted that voting is a right by the 1850s, but there's a lot of question about whether it's a universal right.
Wars often result in limitations on civil liberties, and yet you make the point in your book, The Right to Vote, that wars have often actually seen an expansion of the franchise. Could you give us some examples of that?
Sure. I mean, in fact, I see war as one of the critical dynamic forces in expanding the franchise, which is something that surprised me as I got into this history. Early on, for example, both during the Revolution and during the War of 1812, the militiamen who were recruited to fight against England, many of whom did not have the franchise, insisted on the right to vote and insisted on liberalization of state constitutions. This happened, for example, in Pennsylvania and in Maryland. It was the armed militiamen who demonstrated and said that that they wanted to vote. The fact that African Americans participated in very large numbers in the Civil War was a substantial weight for the argument for passage of the 15th Amendment and for enfranchising African Americans. And in more recent times, one can look even in the post-World War II period, the Native Americans who led the post-World War II struggles for the franchise in key states such as New Mexico and Arizona were invariably veterans of World War II with the credibility that inhered in them. The same was true of black veterans, and one could also look at the way in which the war in Vietnam and the threat of the draft had the effect of producing a lowering of the voting age. What happens when the dynamics really are twofold, although linked? One is that a country fighting a war has to recruit an army. And in general, elites have been in control of American foreign policy, but they can't produce an army entirely out of elites and want to recruit people from different classes. And to do that without enfranchising them is difficult. More broadly, there's a need to mobilize public support politically for wars. And that, for example, during World War I, even the enfranchisement of women was treated as something that was politically necessary to mobilize support for the war. I mean, Woodrow Wilson himself, in announcing his support for the 19th Amendment, declared that Congress should pass it as a war measure.
Oh, you spoke earlier of the rising percentage of American adults who can vote, 20 to 40% at earlier times, close to 100% now. Superficially, at least, that suggests that there's been a steady increase in the expansion of the franchise. Yet one of the points in your book is that that has not been the case, really. Expansion of the franchise has been neither inevitable nor straightforward. In fact, there have been times when the franchise has actually contracted, when Americans in certain groups actually lost the right to vote that they once had.
Yes, that's true. I mean, in fact, you know, if one does a long-term graph of those percentages, yes, over the very long run, the trend is towards expansion. But with many, many ups and downs, the most well-known, of course, is the disfranchisement of African Americans in the South. After Reconstruction, there's a brief period when they are permitted to vote and they lose that right to vote. But that's by no means the only example. And there are a variety of laws, which I talk about in the book, that are passed in northern states in the late 19th century that are aimed, in effect, at disfranchising immigrant workers or members of the working class in general. Literacy tests, for example, are passed in a number of northern states. New York State passes a literacy test in 1921, and it remains on the books and enforced into the mid-1960s. And as one recent sign that even today these movements backward can occur, that in Massachusetts, my own state, in election 2000, the state voted to disfranchise convicted felons, which had never been the case before.
The obstacles that African Americans and women have had to overcome to vote are pretty well known, I think. And yet, as significant as those are, you conclude that historically it's class tensions and apprehensions that constitute the single most important obstacle to universal suffrage in the United States from the 18th century to the 1960s. Could you talk about those class obstacles?
Sure. I think that they appear... Well, they're certainly present at the time of the writing of the Constitution. There was a sense that, for example, that people should own property in order to vote. And the distinction between the propertied and the unpropertied was a class distinction. In the 19th century, and I think this is a very critical peculiarity of American history, what we have is the phenomenon of a broadening of the franchise before there was any significant industrialization, but only just before there was significant industrialization and thus the formation of an industrial working class. And what occurs in one state after another, and I think one can see the pattern quite clearly, is that when industry does grow and also attracts immigration, there is a very pronounced sense of, oh my God, what have we done in the mid-19th and late 19th century? And it is a class reaction. It is a reaction on the part of the middle classes and the elites against the political empowerment of people who are poor, people who work with their hands, and who are often not literate. And I think that dynamic really plays itself out way into the 20th century. I think it's also the case, for example, if one looks at the disfranchisement of African Americans in the South, that it is the overlap of race and class that makes the imperative of disfranchisement seem so powerful to white middle class and white elite Southerners. I mean, African Americans in the end are not in the late 19th century when the disfranchisement is brutal. Is, you know, they are not simply a separate race, people of a different skin color. They are also the agricultural working class of the South.
What did the Voting Rights Act of 1965 accomplish?
Well, in its most straightforward way, what the Voting Rights Act was legislation that empowered the federal government to enforce the 15th Amendment, which had been passed in 1868 and said that race, color, previous condition of servitude could not be a criteria for voting. I mean, what the Voting Rights Act, in effect, tried to do was to create an enforcement mechanism for that, and that is what it did. How in doing that, however, and it was quite notable, it provoked a series of court cases and actions that overturned other sort of barriers to enfranchisement as well. For example, it's the Voting Rights Act and is what ends up, in effect, coupled with an action of the Supreme Court, terminating literacy tests for voting. But on its face, it was simply an attempt to enforce the 15th Amendment. But the 15th Amendment had not been enforced, and that was a very powerful commitment of the federal government.
We began by talking about how the right to vote, including exclusions from voting, belonged originally to the states and how there was no right enshrined in the national constitution. Given the court decisions that you've alluded to, given things like the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and so on, do we have now a de facto national right to vote?
We have, I'd say, a de facto quasi-right to vote. What I mean by adding the word quasi in there is that the Voting Rights Act, and actually much more importantly the rulings of the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's use of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment basically said that the states cannot discriminate among people in terms of granting the right to vote and withholding the right to vote, according to numerous possible lines. I mean, they cannot discriminate based on literacy, they cannot discriminate based on age if you're over 18, that they cannot discriminate based on length of residence in the state beyond a minimal residency requirement. In doing that, they have created a de facto national right to vote, but it has loopholes. Since there is not an affirmative right to vote, what exists is a national government prohibition of many kinds of restrictions that the states can impose. And for example, in election 2000, and this would deal only with presidential elections, but there are there are other issues that would affect other kinds of elections. In election 2000, the ruling of the Supreme Court in Bush v. Gore made very clear, in effect, that that we do not necessarily possess a right to vote for the presidency. According to the court's view, for example, the Florida legislature could have decided that that Florida's electors would not be chosen by a popular election, but would be chosen by the legislature itself.
After two centuries, the right to vote remains contested.
Very much so.
Professor Kasar, thank you for visiting with us.
Well, thank you.
I've been talking with Alexander Kasar, the author of The Right to Vote, The Contested History of Democracy in the United States.
July 4th is well remembered as the date on which the Continental Congress approved the Declaration of Independence. However, Dr. America suggests we carry over the celebration to July 5th, the date on which a famous American leader offered his reflections on American independence. In the archives of the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, Dr. America shakes the dust off this moving address.
On the 5th of July, 1852, Frederick Douglass spoke to the Ladies' Anti-Slavery Society in Rochester, New York. An escaped slave and abolitionist orator, Douglass was probably the most famous African-American man of his generation. The speech was a magnificent example of the American Jeremiad, a lamentation, a doleful complaint, and an accusation. Named after the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah, such a speech accuses people of sinfulness and calls them to repentance. In both the title and the substance of his speech, Douglass asked his audience and all Americans, "What to the slave is the 4th of July?" Douglass began by noting the irony of the occasion. The Declaration of Independence proclaimed in no uncertain terms that all men are created equal. But the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 said virtually the opposite. In this context, Douglass asked his privileged audience, "What to the American slave is your 4th of July?" And in the central accusation of the whole speech, Douglass answered that for the slave, it was a day that reveals to him more than all the other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. Even so, Douglass concluded in the spirit of hope. He thought that people were beginning to respond to the true principles of the Declaration, and he was right. Within 20 years, the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation, and 3 constitutional amendments had wiped legal slavery from the books. Jeremiah's, like Douglass's speech, had redeemed the Declaration's promises of liberty and equality. Like Douglass, many great Americans come from the prophetic tradition of American reform, using what Dr. America calls declaratory sentences. Over and over again, American radicals have challenged the status quo by declaring that Americans need to live their declaration. The Jeremiads of people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Eugene Debs and Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez have helped to fulfill some of the promises of 1776, but not all of them. The 5th of July is a good day to look at the silences of the 4th and to consider whether or not we will declare our independence from ideas and institutions that still enslave others. In a country with no legal slavery, we need to ask who's still not quite equal, who's still in captivity, who is our contemporary Frederick Douglass disturbing our peace for justice.
You've been listening to James Farrell, known on Minnesota Public Radio as Dr. America. Farrell is a professor of history at St. Olaf College in Northville, Minnesota. His commentary comes to us courtesy of WCAL-FM in Minneapolis, St. Paul. This is Talking History. Thank you. Independence Day be called to your attention a little-known but historic community dating to the time of American independence. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Driving along the Delaware Turnpike, heading for Colonial Williamsburg, you might not realize you were just a short distance from one of the most picturesque, historic, and dignified 18th century towns, Newcastle, Delaware. It was the state's first capital from 1776 to 1777, and the town offers visitors masterpieces of 18th century architecture and largely unchanged colonial landscapes without the crowds of more familiar tourist spots. And each May, the town offers a day in Old Newcastle when many of the private homes and gardens are open to the public. Standing on the village green, you'll be transported back 200 years because so little has changed since the town hit its peak in 1800. The Presbyterian Church, built in 1707, is still in use, as is the old courthouse that was built in 1732. A day in Newcastle is a day well spent.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we call your attention to three History Channel programs that tell the story of three different kinds of founding fathers. On July 13th, look for the 3 1-hour biographies on Dave Thomas, Ray Kroc, and Harlan Sanders. In Dave Thomas, Made to Order, the History Channel tells the story of the lovable guy behind the Wendy's fast food empire. He began with Kentucky Fried Chicken and invented the famous bucket of chicken with Colonel Sanders' face on it. After leaving KFC, he started doing Wendy's commercials in 1989, the first of 500. Right after that, Ray Kroc, fast food McMillionaire, profiles the entrepreneur who founded McDonald's. It traces Kroc's rise from days distributing the multi-mixer, which could mix 5 milkshakes at a time, to his meeting the restaurant owners Dick and Mac McDonald, which led to the creation of the McDonald's chain of restaurants. And finally, stay tuned for Colonel Sanders, America's Chicken King. Here's your chance to know the real Colonel Harlan Sanders. He spent most of his life bouncing from job to job and collected his first Social Security check before becoming a success, before his chicken recipe hit it big. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact show times of these History Channel presentations. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.